this is Denise Yan, and welcome to the Brand is Business Bites podcast. The Brand is Business Bites podcast gives you a taste of insights and information about brands, businesses, and the people who work on them. It's available on iTunes. For more stuff for your brain to chew on, please visit my website at deniseleeyan.com. Hello, today's interview is with the brilliant thinker and professional provocateur, Jonathan Salem Baskin. Now, you might be familiar with Jonathan because he wrote a book with a great title and even better content called Branding Only Works on Cattle, but you might also recognize some of the brands he has led marketing initiatives for, Apple, Blockbuster, ConAgra. He currently manages the North American business for the global marketing consultancy Future Lab. And I love reading Jonathan's blog, Dimbulb, as well as his regular column for Advertising Age on marketing leadership. So when I saw that Jonathan had a new book out, I just had to invite him to be interviewed. So his latest book, Histories of Social Media, analyzes 2,000 years of history to uncover ideas and tips for today's work with social media. It's pretty fascinating and fun stuff. So let's welcome Jonathan. Hello.
Hey there, Denise. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk.
Well, I'm so excited to hear more about this book. So I want to start with why you wrote it. You know, the author Pearl Buck once said, if you want to understand today, you have to search yesterday. But I've also heard the adage, you know, the past is always a rebuke to the present. So I'm wondering, which is it for you? Are you trying to help people understand social media today, or are you trying to rebuke the way people are using it, or what? Why did you write this?
Yeah, well, the short answer is yes. and the longer answer of why I wrote it really was sort of an unconscious dare by my teenage daughter. We periodically have these conversations, these playful give and takes where, you know, she'll be dumbfounded by the characteristics of my childhood, which she equates with growing up in the Stone Age. And early last year, 2010, we were having one of those conversations, and it was, you know, kind of, you can imagine the list, you know, so Dad, you mean you had no computers when you were growing up? Well, not really, no. You had no cell phones? No. And then there's this pause, and she looks at me with a serious face and says, so that means you had no Facebook? And it occurred to me then and there, oh my goodness, the sort of prevailing wisdom, the prevailing opinion is that prior to the technology platforms that really were nascent in the 50s but really didn't come online until the Internet came online, the World Wide Web in the late 1980s, beginning in the 1990s, that really not only my childhood, but that all of human history prior was sort of this dark ages of disconnectedness, of loneliness, of aloneness. It kind of was a dare to me. And so I kind of sat down and spent some quality time thinking about it and pretty quickly discovered, sort of rediscovered, if you will, from my childhood, that I was anything but living in a vacuum and living on a deserted island of loneliness. In fact, I was deeply connected and interconnected through a variety of networks. And then it kind of thought to me, huh, okay, if that was true for me, was it true for somebody living, let's say, in the 1850s in the American South, or in the 1700s in Paris, or in the 1400s in a small town in England, or in the Roman Empire? And that led to the sort of the concept of the histories of social media, which was, I wanted to kind of take the technology off the table because I think it skewed not only my daughter's perspective but really my own about how we define what social media and social engagement is or are, the engagements are. And once I took the technology off the table, it allowed me to actually do a lot of historical research, interview a fair number of medievalists who, I will tell you, Denise, were quite surprised to have somebody want to talk to them about social experience. And riff really on the concept, and that became the 9 chapters of Histories of Social Media.
Wow. You know, it's almost, in hearing you talk about it, it's almost as if you know, what we know as our current state is what we know. And, you know, I think that we probably think that we're fairly technologically advanced in the way that we connect and engage with each other. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I wonder if you'd asked me 30 years ago, I probably would have said the same thing. And
yeah.
You know, I wonder if 3,000 years ago they would have said the same thing.
Well, yeah,
right?
And
you only know what you know.
Absolutely, and it was a real revelation for me. Again, you know, and it's funny because it happens as you get older, particularly. I mean, I have the distinct you know, misfortune of being old enough to remember when 1984 was the future. And when 2001 was the future.
Yeah.
And once in my life, I hit those milestones and realized it was no longer the future. It was the present. And the future was actually 10 years further out. It turns out I've kind of been aware for a while now that every generation lives on this cusp of the future. There were a bunch of people sitting around in togas in Athens 2,000 years ago thinking, whoa, this is the cutting edge of tomorrow. Because it was. And, you know, our technology is different now. It absolutely, you know, I'm not dumb enough to think that technology doesn't have implications and effects that are unique to the technology. I mean, I'm a big Marshall McLuhan fan. I do believe, at least in some ways, the medium is the message. So there's no way to say, well, yeah, you know, we have the internet now, and so it's really the same thing as the trade routes that ships trolled during the medieval era. I mean, they're parallels, but they're not the same thing. Technology is different now. But with that said, is that difference the core defining quality of the experience, or is it an enhancement, or is it a qualifier of that experience? And my premise, at least in the book, is the latter. It is, it changes it, it expands it, it amplifies it, it confuses it. There are good and bad qualities, but the core behaviors that define social experience are actually consistent throughout all of history. And we tend to, I think, blind ourselves with our sense of uniqueness and specialness, thinking, well, here we are new on the planet, and we're discovering stuff, and it must be new because we're discovering it. And it's kind of humbling to realize, oh, my God, you know, there were folks in, you know, revolutionary times in Paris, France, feeling that they were also discovering things for the first time, and it turns out that they were actually just reading. Who's the philosopher, George Santayana, who said something kind of like the Pearl Buck quote you have? It's, you know, those who don't learn the mistakes of history are doomed to repeat them.
Right.
And I think we spend a lot of time rediscovering stuff. We actually don't have to rediscover. We actually know if we just look. So to answer your question about is it a rebuke to social media or not? I'm a believer, and I think that the potential for social technologies as a subset of social experience is literally infinite, and I'm blown away by the potential. And what I want to do with my book is kind of provide a grounding on the behavioral and on the social aspect of that promise, so that we can get a better handle on what we're trying to do with the technology. If
right.
That makes any sense.
Right. Yeah, well, actually, so can you give us an example or two of some of the lessons that or insights that we might have about social media based on what we can learn from history?
Sure. The first one's, I think, probably really broad and probably maddeningly so, and that is this idea that conversation is a new experience and that conversation has an innate value. It doesn't. It never did. The idea that we can converse with our customers or with our vendors or with our suppliers or with our critics, the definition we have of conversation as being this net new tool that we're able to bring to bear, whether we're a corporation or a public entity or a nonprofit or a government concern or just as individuals, is so bereft of any validity from a historical perspective. All of history shows us that every social structure, I mean, by definition, social is the Latin root that on which society is based. So mm-hmm. When we talk about social experience, we're really talking about civilization. And civilization, people within civilizations have been talking to one another and with one another and at one another and about one another since time began. And just that, let alone just that observation, that realization of the ununiqueness, if there's such a word, disuniqueness, X uniqueness of conversation, whatever it is, I think right away then changes the way we approach what our purposes are in starting conversations. Because I'd argue that a lot of the social campaigns that marketers do these days and that we marketers celebrate, celebrate the idea of engagement, for instance, as being a net good thing, an absolute good thing. It's a net addition because we're able to converse with people and conversing with them is good. What we actually converse about is important, but it's almost secondary to this functionality that we've discovered called conversation. I think Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this a while ago in The New Yorker, and not that I agree with everything he said, but conversation without purpose and without sort of affirmation in reality and without outcomes and without implications and without requirements and all these things that define conversation that mattered and had relevance and meaning throughout all of history, if we don't have those as part of our marketing conversations, we're kind of just wasting everybody's time. And I think that might be why we have some trouble finding measures and metrics that are believable and sustainable and realistic, because we're looking at conversation sort of in a vacuum and not looking at it as really just an ongoing experience. I mean, brands in the 50s talked and had conversations with their customers. Now, we might laugh at it, but they had conversations. They told the market things, the market shared things, people referred things, they recommended, they pushed back. Again, we could laugh and say that they were, you know, effectively cavemen and women trying to, you know, conduct business, but there were conversations that went on. So, again, I get back to this idea that we look at conversation now as if it's an absolute good, and I don't think it is. So that's one observation. The second one is probably a little less broad, but it's an offshoot of conversation, and that is I'm fascinated with our fascination about crowdsourcing, because it's sort of a given. It's an article of faith today that the crowd is intelligent and that the crowd knows better than the individual. Whatever it is, you know, let's wikiify it and it'll get better. And if you look at history, anybody living before about 1950, had you said that to them, they would have laughed in your face. Because the reality of the crowd through all of history, up until about 1950, 1960, and actually through the 60s, was that the crowd was either mad or insane or angry or just simply easily led and foolish. You know, Charles Mackay wrote a great book in the 1840s in the United Kingdom called Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And it was a typical Victorian sort of pseudo-statistical analysis of crowd behavior through the ages. And the conclusion was crowds tend to follow the wrong people, reach the wrong conclusions, and then reaffirm to one another why they're actually right when in fact they're wrong and dig themselves deeper into holes. So, not to say that that is set in stone or digitally unavoidable, but again, if our starting point here is that the challenge for innovation for business is to figure out how to open up its management and crowdsource its decision-making, I would argue or just ask, is that necessarily a legitimate starting point for marketing or business strategy? And if so, why is it? What is different now about people and about human behavior and about social experience that suggests that it's any more valid than it was throughout the rest of history when it was absolutely invalid? And that's not to say that there aren't answers and there aren't opportunities, because the technology does give us tools to approach it somewhat differently. But fundamentally, is the problem with companies today that they don't crowdsource and open up enough of their management to the rest of the world? That's a statement of faith. That's a fact, according to our social convention these days. And I just offer up, maybe that's not so true. And maybe right. That's not the problem that we need to fix. So that's two observations. And again, by the way, Denise, I don't want to presume that I'm necessarily, I have not in my, you know, sort of brilliance here and real modesty intended here, I haven't discovered the answers to these questions. I don't know what they are. I just know that if we ask them differently, I bet you the smart people now who are in our field could maybe come up with better answers, but only if they ask different questions. And so far, they're not asking these kinds of questions.
Right. Yeah. And the first step is to question. So I think that that's something that I've always appreciated about what you bring to the conversation is just asking the tough questions, the questions that no one wants to ask, the questions that people don't think to ask because they're so obvious, or they think the answer is so obvious.
Right.
So you know, I think that if nothing else, if this gets people thinking in a different way, you know, you've done a great service, right?
Well, and that was my goal. And, you know, in the introduction, I say I'm really just trying to start a different conversation about conversation, because again, I'm a believer. We are, you know, I think the impact and relevance and future of social media is so incomprehensibly huge, and it's so much bigger than marketers. It's so much bigger than business management. It's about how we structure our society and how we conduct it and how we experience it. It's enormous. So I'm a believer, but it just, especially with this historical perspective, you look at a lot of the uses that we put social to, and we are busy trying to then tell one another why it's a good thing. You know, I do a lot of, I'm on the blogger board of Social Media Today, and I'll tell you, you know, most of the blog posts on that site are all about, here are the top 10 reasons you should have a Facebook page, or the top 15 ways to do Twitter feeds, or how, you know, it's all about sort of this vocational approach to realizing these articles of faith. Produce more content, publish more things. You're no longer in business making stuff, you're curating stuff. All these wonderfully cool, intricate, complicated new ideas. And once you see the history and you see it in the light of day, it's like, oh my God, what are we talking about? This, you know, why are we coming up with all this crazy stuff when, if you just look at social experience throughout the ages, it's crazy enough. We don't need new metrics. We just need new approaches to addressing these old problems.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I feel passionately about this just because it's so damn interesting. I mean, I don't know about you. Were you a liberal arts major in college?
I was.
Well,
so
was I. And that's a good thing. I don't know about you, but I think I took maybe one history course in college. The rest of it was history through literature because I was an English literature major. But the only straight-up history course I took was sort of an overview of modern world history as my freshman year in college. And I just wonder how many folks in the marketing field today were communications majors or other liberal arts majors that didn't necessarily spend that much time actually studying history. So it's not that I'm suggesting they're dumb. It's just they were never really exposed to it. And especially not with the lens that I'm trying to apply to it. And it's just sort of like, it's a revelation.
Right, right. Well, this has been great, Jonathan. And I think that what you've done is whetted everyone's appetites to read your book.
Yeah, I hope
and
so.
I also wanted to mention for my listeners that Jonathan has a blog, which is a companion to his book, in which every day he takes an event from history and explores its implications for social strategy and our culture overall. And actually, his very first post was about crowdsourcing, and it referenced the bubonic plague in the 1300s. So if you want to hear more about the thoughts and questions that Jonathan has about crowdsourcing, you might want to check that out. You can do that. You can access his blog as well as learn more about his book through the website called historiesofsocialmedia.com. So it's all one word strung together, historiesofsocialmedia.com. And you can learn more about Jonathan and contact him directly through his website, jonathansalembaskin.com. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. You leave me always with tons of questions and things to think about, and so I really appreciate it.
Oh, I enjoy our interaction, Denise, so thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
All right,
talk
take
to
care.
You soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening to the Brand as Business Bites podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so your brain will always be filled with good stuff to chew on. For more information or to contact me directly, please visit my website at DeniseLeeYon.com. Take care, and thanks again.